40 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. New details emerging in New Mexico about a defeated GOP candidate accused of targeting the homes of four Democratic state officials. CBS's Steve Futterman has more on the story.
Investigators say Solomon Pena hired people to shoot at the homes of two county commissioners and a pair of New Mexico state senators. Kyle Hartzik is with the Albuquerque Police Department.
The evidence that we have is not only firearm, but it's also from cell phones and electronic records, surveillance video.
Police say in one of the attacks, Pena went along with the shooters and attempted to fire a gun himself, but it malfunctioned. Pena has a criminal record. He spent 5 years in prison. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
A $10,000 reward is being offered for information leading to the arrest of two suspects wanted in yesterday's massacre in a Central California home. Among the victims, a 16-year-old mother and her 10-month-old baby. KGPE-TV's Esteban Reynoso reports.
The sheriff says the home in Goshen is well known to law enforcement. A narcotics search warrant was conducted earlier this month, and drugs and guns were found inside.
Not all these people in this home are gang members. Definitely this 10-month-old child is an innocent victim.
Sheriff Boudreau says the investigation has already taken them outside of Tulare County.
Make no mistake, I'm not saying that this is a cartel, but also be clear that I am not eliminating that possibility.
In California, the rain has finally stopped, but some residents of Ocampo remain under a mandatory evacuation order as floodwater spreads. This woman is one of them.
This is definitely horrific for us. There's nowhere for the water to go, so we're screwed at this point.
President Biden heads to California on Thursday to see the damage. A Massachusetts man, Brian Walsh, has been charged with the murder of his wife, who has been missing since New Year's Day. CBS's Nancy Chen with more.
Investigators tell our CBS Boston station WBZ that their search of a nearby waste facility turned up trash cans with blood, a hatchet, a hacksaw, and a rug. Prosecutors say Walsh was also caught on tape, purchasing $450 worth of cleaning supplies.
A Russian mercenary seeks asylum in Norway. CBS's Vicky Barker has more from our foreign desk.
Andrei Medvedev says he deserted from the notorious Wagner mercenary group in Ukraine and crossed from Russia into Norway on foot, seeking asylum there. He says he's willing to collaborate with international investigators probing possible war crimes in Ukraine.
Actor Jeremy Renner says he's home from the hospital after being treated for serious injuries from a snowplow accident. Renner was run over by his own plow in Nevada while trying to use it to free a relative's vehicle on a private road near Lake Tahoe. That was on New Year's Day. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, that's design.garden.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm. Built for real life.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio. Dana Perry. Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
27% of the American workforce, and some even say 30%, were in unions who had representation and who clearly did not have to worry about whether or not they were going to get their fair share. But I'm definitely going to fight for people who get the short end of the stick in this society only because they don't have representation. That's who I am.
Check out the Earl Ingram Show every day from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. only on WAUK 540 a.m. 101 FM, The Shaw.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which right. was audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
Oh. We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
I open my door. I got some neighbors that open their door.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today on your lunch hour. As always, you can join the conversation at 844-967-2789. And so it's not breaking news that Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And for some people, they know how it got that way. But for a lot of us, it's kind of this just it is. But in reality, it became that way by design. And so two University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee professors are leading an effort to document and map what shaped the racial geography of not only just the city, but Milwaukee County in a project called Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County. So here today to help us talk about the project are those two professors, Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds. Derek is an assistant professor in the English Department of Public Rhetoric and Community Engagement at UWM. And Ann Bonds is an associate professor and associate chair of geography and an affiliate faculty member of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So let's just start, because I think sometimes people come to this conversation around segregation in Milwaukee. And it's not just a story of Milwaukee. I mean, I think Chicago, you see Chicago and Detroit and so many other large metropolitan areas. I think a lot that during the last century, like a century ago, kind of how they forced people to live in certain neighborhoods. And so the tactic I'm more familiar with is redlining. So for people who don't know what redlining is, could either of you explain that?
Yeah, sure. There's been a great deal of interest in redlining, and it's really wonderful that everybody's learning more about this. Redlining maps come from an institution, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, established by the federal government following the Depression, really to try to stabilize housing prices. And the Homeowners Loan Corporation was tasked with essentially kind of mapping a few over 200 cities and their kind of real estate markets to identify places where it would be safe to invest and areas that would be, as they were termed, risky for investment. So it was really, these maps were used, they kind of graded neighborhoods or areas of the city. And so redlined areas are called such because they were colored red on these maps. And these were places that were marked as risky or not safe for financial lending, and essentially barring whole neighborhoods or portions of cities from mortgage lending. And so certainly redlining had a powerful effect on segregation. But what we're here to talk with you about today is racial covenants, which actually existed before these maps were made, and they were being utilized. And in fact, sometimes the redlining maps were drawn around areas with covenants.
So that was what, and in learning about the project, I've heard of like the handshake deals that was kind of like the implicit like understanding of who you sold your house to. But when reading more about the project, it was the first time I've even heard this term covenant. So can you tell me more about what those were and how prevalent and prominent they were in Milwaukee County?
Sure. Covenants are just clauses that are inserted into property deeds, and they stipulate how a property can be used, how what the appearance should look like of properties, even the value of property. So when you get into these covenants, you're reading things about garage setbacks, for example, or the building heights that are required or the stipulations for building heights in neighborhoods. And what also is included in here, up until, you know, they were made illegal, were racial covenants, which explicitly stated that certain groups were not allowed to live in certain areas. And they are actually quite extensive and detailed, often in terms of their legality. There'll be long stipulations in these covenants about, nobody can live here, but also after you sell the house, even the successors or heirs to this property can't sell. So they're very explicit in barring people of color, especially African-Americans, from neighborhoods.
And even though they're illegal, some of this language is still present today in people's in deeds, their housing deeds. There was a person who told me from Madison when her and her husband bought the house, they were reading, one of the few people who actually read all of
the fine print,
right?
The terms of service,
right? And they came across this and said, hey, what's this? So it's, even though it, like I said, even though it's out, it's illegal in some places, it's still in their deeds.
And so the fact that it's still in the deeds in some places, is that just because people don't read the fine print and it just it continues to exist, or is there people who are still complicit and just trying to get away with it?
They're not functional, so they don't serve the purpose that they were designed to initially.
Okay.
So they can't be used, but they certainly have a symbolic power. They tell you about the history of a neighborhood, how it was formed, who was excluded. They're written into the deed. Oftentimes, these were meant to run with the land. It's often stated, which means that it runs with the property, and so they're just included in that legalese language. And so, yeah, you know, this people's interest in this project means that a lot of folks have gone out and gone to look at their own property records and see what they can find, and they're finding that yes, in fact, there were racial covenants, there was a racial covenant attached to their property, and they didn't know about it because it's buried in, you know, all of these documents. And you can access the original property record for any property at the Register of Deeds office. And, you know, they can help you find it. It's somewhat difficult or it can take some time. You definitely need the support of the people in the office. And you can see your original property record. And that's where you would find these kinds of details.
So the project, from what I understand, seems kind of like a Herculean task of what you both are set out to do with the help of a lot of volunteers. So tell me more and tell the audience more about what the project is.
Well, I think I'm going to let Anne talk a little bit more because she began this process early on. She was going to the deed register's office and kind of looking these up one at hand. So I'll let you share the story and then I'll show. Share when I jump in.
Sounds good. I'm interested in segregation and race, and I always, as a geographer, feel like maps are a really powerful way to help us see the way that social dynamics become embedded or connected to certain places. And so I teach a class called the Geography of Race, and I had seen a couple of examples where people had made these interfaces to show the history of segregation. And I was interested in doing this myself, kind of thinking about the way that all of these things kind of overlapped and created these various boundaries in the city for people of color. And, you know, the redlining itself, how did the redlining maps and the Hulk map for Milwaukee from 1938 connect to these other dynamics? And so I started digging into covenants, and I knew they existed. There's a great report written by Lois Quinn from 1979, which cataloged some of these. And so, of course, we're grateful for her work. But there's nothing exhaustive because it's very difficult. And we're talking, of course, about thousands and thousands and thousands of documents. So it is a Herculean effort in that respect. And so somewhere along the line, as I was, you know, one semester, I always tell the story because it kind of gives you a sense that, you know, my research assistant and I were combing through records. And one semester, we were really excited because we found about 50 that hadn't been documented before, which was great. But, you know, when we're talking about thousands and thousands of racially restrictive covenants that likely exist, we knew that this was going to be something that would take years and years and years.
Yeah.
And then I met some colleagues at the University of Minnesota. They had a project called Mapping Prejudice, and they're now people that we collaborate with. And they had this really innovative way of doing the project where they got digitized copies of the property records. And so what we've done the same thing. And then they run this through software, an optical character recognition software, and they're actually flagging certain terminology using scripts, but to flag language. So we know that Caucasian is a word, Caucasians only, whites. We see the language apologies in advance to listeners for offensive language. We see terms like colored people. We see terms like African. We see they through all of their research and support of our project, they become experts on these, and they've helped us kind of put together a set of words to flag. And so from that then, so we initially started with 1.7 million images.
Oh my God.
And we took those images were converted to text, they're run through the software. And now we have a core data set of about 21,000 records. And so we're going through those records now with volunteers, which is the important part of the process. We're working together with volunteers to look at those deeds and say, yes, do they have a covenant, or no, do they have a covenant?
Yeah.
Because machines aren't humans and they make mistakes. And so there are certain things that could be flagged that could be like racial language that might be flagged. And it turns out, nope, they're not actually covenants. So that's the process we're in right now, is working through those covenants with volunteers.
Got it. So we're talking to UWM professors Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds about their Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County project. And so I think it's interesting because a geography professor and a English professor walk into a bar. It's like the beginning of a joke. And so quickly, we'll come back and talk more about the project and the importance of it and what it can accomplish by the volunteers and really being able to map this. But as far as the two disciplines and how they overlap for this project, how did they, because I think people tend to think literature and English sits over here and geography and urban studies sits over here. And so how do you two see the two disciplines working together on this project?
Well, so this is where I come into the story. So when I first came to UWM, I was familiar with Anne's work. And so I reached out to her just to talk about her work, and because there was an article that she had wrote that I found very interesting. And we met and we talked, and she first mentioned this project that she was doing. I think this was early in 2020. So it was in the back of my hand and back of my head. And then, of course, as we know, the summer of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, and there was this awakening. My own work, I look at the ways in which African-American communities respond to urban renewal in the 50s and 60s. So I'm very interested in Black organizing. I am in English department, but my work is interdisciplinary. And so I remember her project, and I reached out to her and to see where it was. And we met and we discussed, and we came up with this approach to the project now, that we wanted to map the racism and resistance, because this is something that the African-American community already knew about early in the 20th century. We're very familiar with the, you know, open housing marches in the late 60s, but the Black community, Black Milwaukee, had been protesting, resisting these housing practices way back in the 1920s, if not earlier. So we wanted to tell the whole story. And so that's kind of like how we came together. Yeah. And neither one of us is a, a history, professor. So we've had help from our research team.
So I'm going to cut you off.
Sure.
We're coming back right after the break. Professor Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds will still be here to talk about Mapping Racism and Resistance. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Just really trying to break in. Get away from my car. Get away. Hey, Kitty J. Hey, Daryl Lee. Hey, Roscoe.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
We have to really understand how critically important a time this is. Time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Because my voice has always been and will continue to be for people who don't have a voice.
Tune in to The Earl Ingram Show every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Only on WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, The Shaw.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. Overcast overnight with lows around 31. Winds out of the west, 8 to 15 miles an hour. Overcast again tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 36. A mixture of precipitation likely tomorrow night. Lows level off around 32. Cloudy skies expected. 1 to 2 inches of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 34 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are here with Professor Ann Bond and Derek Hanley, and we were talking a little too much with the break, and now we're back. Jane's giving me the eye. She's like, are you going to talk? But we are talking about the Mapping Racism and Resistance Project that they've started over at UWM. And Professor Hanley, I'll let you finish the point you were talking about before we had to break.
Yes. That's just basically what I was saying is this is how the project came about. And we've been very happy about the reception and people wanting to volunteer and how much they want to be a part of it, because this is a community project and we've thought of it as such. And so the community is helping us with this project and to tell this larger story.
And so with that, I mean, besides just the fact that you need people power to go through 21,000 documents that is already down from over a million documents. But as far as the qualitative benefit, both for the project, but also for the people who are going to volunteer to help go through this, what do you think the value of that is to have so many more people just from the public and not academia be involved?
We've had folks ask this question, you know, with AI software, you know, we could just use AI software and we wouldn't need to do this. And we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
We clearly rely on digital methods in multiple ways on the project. But what we have found and our collaborators is that reading the deeds is incredibly powerful. It's a really important opportunity for us to understand and read and engage with the way that these deeds and this kind of these mechanisms were at work. I think you started out our interview saying, you know, we just kind of understand segregation is kind of just the way it is, or it's just kind of normalized. But, you know, people are very surprised when they see the kind of the ways in which, you know, there's an active role that homeowners, real estate developers, home builders, insurers, that we're all kind of involved in this process. And so it's really revealing for people to really, I think it's powerful for people to learn that their properties have covenants themselves and to kind of reflect and think on that. But it's also just in terms of the community, it's helping us to understand how we got to where we are. So I think there's a really important learning point. And of course, just learning about histories of racism and the way that their legacies continue, in our own urban environments.
And if I just you get insight to the ways in which race was conceptualized in the early 20th century in the language. And we like to prepare folks that you're going to read some things that's very problematic.
Yeah.
And possibly be upsetting because it's right there. It's one thing to hear that a place is historically segregated. It's another thing to read it and to see it and how matter of fact it was and how it was written into to these deeds. That if a person sold their house to someone who was not of the white race, that they were at risk of losing their home.
Wow.
Forfeiture. So this is what we mean by, you know, when it said it's by design, there was legal consequences if you violated these deeds.
And so when the project, at least the goal, when the project is done, how do you two envision it living on as far as consumption for more people to be able to understand it? Like, do you see it as literally being a map?
Yeah, it will literally be a map, but it will be a digital resource embedded on a website, which right now we just kind of have a placeholder while we're, you know, doing this part of the project. But we'll have a lot of maps. People will be able to search these maps. They'll be able to look up their own properties. So we've done some of the legwork, or we will have at some point in time when these are up. And we also have resources documenting, as Derek said earlier, how Black Milwaukeeans and their allies were challenging these efforts. So we'll have, you know, we'll kind of have these kind of interactive maps. And it's also a website that we hope we can collect people's stories. And already we're hearing a lot of stories. People have reached out to us to tell us about their own covenants or their family's experiences being excluded from certain neighborhoods because of their racial identity. And so we want this resource to be a tool, community produced and community, you know, it'll be owned at the university, but at the same time, we want it to be a resource for anybody who wants to go and learn more about this or who needs the information for their own purposes, community groups, city leaders, for anybody.
Yeah. So then last question, are you still looking for volunteers? How many volunteers do you need in total, or what's the hope?
Well, we're about, I think we were just talking about this, a fifth of the way through our 21,000 the documents that we need to read through. So clearly we are still in need of volunteers. You can be a volunteer and just look through one document, as some people are. They do it once and they get the experience and they learn from it. Or you can be a volunteer who does hundreds. And we have some volunteers that are very invested in this and they've been doing it. So we're looking for all levels of support. If people have time and interest, we'll share more information about upcoming. We have both virtual transcription events and then we'll have future in-person events throughout the coming spring and summer until we're done. And I can kind of preview that we'll be releasing some preliminary maps in March. So we'll have some maps up to cause teasers to keep interest alive as we're working through these along the way.
All right. Well, we will put all of the information if you are interested in volunteering, because you don't have to be in Milwaukee, right?
Nope.
You can do it virtually.
Yep. Do it virtually.
Anywhere from the state. We will put
or the country. We have people all over the place. Yeah.
There you go.
And can I just add one thing?
Yep.
That each deed has to be verified from five different people. So need so many volunteers. Because we want to verify the language in these deeds. So each deed has to have five different readers of it.
Thank you, Derek. I forgot to mention that.
That is an important distinction. Okay. So if you are interested in this project, we will have all the information of how you can sign up and learn more on our episode blog for today. Professor Ann Bonds, Professor Derek Hanley, thank you so much for making the trip to Waukesha and being here in person today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to take another break and we'll be back in just a minute. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. Police in Albuquerque, New Mexico, say failed candidate Solomon Pena is in custody, charged with arranging drive-by shootings targeting the homes of four lawmakers. CBS's Skyler Henry.
He ran as a Republican for a New Mexico State House seat in November.
Police say after he lost the election, he hired four people to commit the shootings at the homes of Democratic officials. A police report ties the shootings to Pena's vehicle.
Police in Central California are looking for the killers of six people who lived in the same home. CBS's Steve Futterman is on the story.
The killings were discovered early Monday morning. Tulare County Sheriff believes the killings are related to drugs and gangs. He is asking people who live in the rural area to check any security video.
CBS's Nichelle Medina says California is dealing with the after effects of weeks of rains.
Weeks of heavy rain has left the ground throughout California oversaturated, causing roads to buckle and sinkholes to open up.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio, VO5.
Let's do it.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
Cardall put out these weird, sad videos interviewing incapacitated elders in their nursing homes that don't have the ability to say, don't use me as your political prop.
If they are what you say they are, then you shouldn't be doing it how you did it.
Yes, it was the kids using the parents as props. Well, my old man hasn't talked since 76. Of course he would have voted for Trump. That's the evidence. Videos. People that can't talk.
It is wrong. So it's absolutely wrong.
Check out the entire podcast library at darnwi.com.
The Devil's Advocates.
The plaintiff, Donald J. Trump, hereby serves his suit against the defendants. Hillary Clinton and her cohorts orchestrated an unthinkable plot, one that shocks the conscience and is an affront to the nation's democracy. This week on Fox.
You know what I mean? Like you're throwing a few too many adverbs and adjectives in this sentence.
One man, one mission Donald Trump gets made fun of. This is Watergate 2.
Making radio great again.
The Devil's Advocates, because freedom.
But Dom, we've been following a couple of big stories this week. Truck convoy leader has no idea where he is and is driving in circles around I-495. He didn't know precisely where he was going anyways or where he was at the time. Apparently, he put the convoy back on the road, headed back up north, and now he's back in Scranton. So
I totally would have protested this tyranny, but damn, the traffic was so bad.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
We have a full hour with Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley.
Yes, thank you for having me. So glad to be in studio.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
You know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you are a union member or a business owner, picking up your garbage has no partisan lines. Making sure people can get to and from work shouldn't have partisan lines.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw.
Life had a remote control. You could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1 minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
I'm all about the data, about the data, more data. I'm all about the data, more data. I'm all about the data, more data. I'm all about the data, more data.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Network. Thank you for tuning in today. Jane's very excited about her new parody data song because we have Dale Knapp, who is the from the Forward Analytics, which is the research arm of Wisconsin Counties Association. And we're going to continue the conversation about housing because they just put out a new report titled A Housing Hurdle, Demographics Drive Need for More Homes. And in that report, on the low end, they said that the state needs to build at least 140,000 housing units by 2030 to keep up with demand. And so I was fascinated with this because I think whether we're talking about Madison zoning, we're talking about condos, but I know in Green Bay, like everywhere around the state, affordable housing is an issue. And yet it's also coupled with and doesn't seem, it seems conflicting in when we talk about population and in everywhere but Dane County, having a declining working age population. And so here to help us kind of make sense of all of this is Mr. Dale Knapp. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here today.
So let's just start from the beginning, because I think sometimes like needing the definition or starting with a definition is important. So when we talk about affordable housing, what does that actually mean?
Well, first, let me go back even one step before that. So for this report, and people ask us that when we're talking about housing, so people oftentimes just think single family homes, but this we're talking in terms of need. This is a combination of single family homes, condominiums, apartments, you know, sort of the whole gamut. So we're not just talking single family homes. When we're talking about affordable housing, and we got into that a little bit, but affordable housing typically is defined housing in which your housing costs are under 30% of your income. That's generally what's considered affordable.
And because I think sometimes people, when they hear affordable housing, they think of like Section 8, of like low-income housing. And those are two different things, right?
Two different things, definitely, yes.
And so what this report looked at is the decline or the lack of supply of housing that's available for people who, and that falls in their income being, or that falls under the cost being less than 30% of their income. And which makes a lot of sense, because I feel like anecdotally, mortgages are going up, especially with interest rates going up. And so what are some of the causes that got us here? Because I don't think it's just one thing. And so what did you find in this report of like how we got to this point?
Yeah. So one of the things, the big driver of this is really demographics. You know, we did a report in the fall looking at the state's workforce and workforce age population. And we're on a path to, by 2030, have 130,000 fewer 25 to 64 year olds in the state. That's the prime working age population. And so when we put that out, one of the questions we got from a lot of people was, well, that's going to really make the housing shortages and housing affordability, you know, that's going to, you know, make housing more affordable because we were not going to have the demand we did. And they forgot that, yes, there's this big baby boom generation leaving the workforce, but they're going to stay in, like generations past, they're going to stay in their homes for, you know, another 10, 15, 20 years. And so even though that prime workforce population is going to shrink, unless we do something about it, we're still going to need to build, you know, 140,000 housing units just to have homes for the young people that will be coming into the workforce. So that's not even considering affordability. So that's just the number that we're going to need. Now, when you talk about affordable housing, that's where the whole supply and demand comes in. And one of the things that's been, you know, driving the inaffordability to some degree, you know, is, again, it goes back to the baby boom generation. You know, they're moving often when they retire to be near their kids. And so, you know, they're coming into places and driving up home prices. And that, you know, makes it unaffordable in some cases for young people. Now, you mentioned the interest rate issue. That's more recent.
Yeah.
And that's causing a, you know, that's really putting a lot of housing out of reach for a lot of young people, just because, you know, you're looking at a housing payment that may have doubled compared to 2 years ago, what it would have been.
So then, because on the high end, I think the minimum for the report found is 140,000 units.
Yeah.
The high end was like 227,000, right?
Yeah. So
go ahead.
No, so that's, and that's, you know, because again, as I just said, this 140 is really the minimum that we need. If we're happy that our prime working age population is going to decline by 130,000, we're not going to do anything about it. That's what we need. But that workforce problem is going to create all kinds of problems throughout the economy. And so we have to do something about that. And the only way to do that is through migration. you know, having more kids, it's going to take 20 years to create a worker out of that, the new kids. So you have to have housing for them. So to completely solve that problem adds another 50, 60, 70,000 housing units in terms of need. And then we have a third component, which really goes to the affordable housing. The number of young people, young adults under age 35 that are living at home, probably temporarily, you know, just out of college, et cetera, has gone up significantly over the last decade, both here and nationally. And the primary driver of that is the lack of affordable housing. They can't find housing that fits within their budget given their incomes. And that's a problem that again, that needs to be solved. And that adds another 20,000 housing units. So if we want to try to solve kind of all of our problems, you're getting up to 227,000 housing units. And, you know, a big chunk of those have to be affordable housing. They can't be the, you know, if it's a single family home, you know, it can't be the $400,000, $500,000 home. It's got to be something that's affordable. So it's this dual challenge here, really.
And so, and I asked this when we were talking about condos, and maybe condos and the thing that what was talked about in Milwaukee is a different issue, but it seems like kind of the bigger question is the same of like, who's responsible for building affordable housing? Like, whose charter is it to start to address this problem? And, you know, for the developers, as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece said, when specifically talking about condos, is it's more profitable to make apartments versus condos. But like, even for duplexes or condos or single family homes. And so if we need to be building more, who's responsible for building and making sure that what they're building can be in that lower range so people can afford to buy them?
Sure. I mean, really, a lot of it, a lot of it goes to municipal officials. For a couple of reasons. You know, one is before we can even build homes, they have to be creating lots, creating subdivisions, et cetera. And that's one of the challenges that we faced over the last decade is we haven't created enough lots to meet the demand. And that's been helping to drive up prices. But then, you know, part of this is the size of the lot. A lot of places, a lot of communities like larger lots we're seeing, and thus larger homes, that makes them less affordable. And sometimes there's a lot of restrictions in terms of building that drive up costs. So there is that on the municipal side. And then the builder side, they generally make more money off of building bigger homes. So there's clearly a desire to do that. And given lumber prices, given labor shortages, and so wages for carpenters, et cetera, going up, you know, it's a challenge to build. If you're talking about single family homes, it's a challenge to build, you know, a new home, you know, that's of some decent size, you know, maybe it's, you know, 1500 square feet. That seems like an affordable price. It's the economics of it are really challenging. And generally then they don't make as much money off of that. So it's not blame, but there's a lot of competing forces out there. And you know, the other thing is when you have communities now that for years have had homes that are of a certain size or whatever, oftentimes when municipalities look to bring in apartment buildings, et cetera, it's not generally the local officials that are opposed, but they're looking to do that, but their constituents often don't want the apartments there. And so, you know, they put pressure on the local officials, you know, not to approve those kinds of things. And that's a challenge in a lot of places.
And I want to get to that next, but we're talking to Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. And is, not that this is your opinion, but as far as in your research, why do homeowners typically, Is there any data that points to an apartment unit in a neighborhood decreasing home value? That there is kind of this NIMBYism when it comes to either zoning or apartment buildings or mixed use, and having duplexes and stuff. So, like, what is the, as you said, more less than the local officials, but more of the constituents who don't want that? What reasoning, what well-founded reasoning do they have to not want that?
Well, in terms of the residents that are in the immediate vicinity, what you're talking about is often, a relatively large amount of traffic coming from, because the apartment building is there, compared to single family homes. So, that's one of the reasons. And there's a variety of reasons, but the home values, there's so many factors that go into home values, and you can look at home values in general would go up if you have more young people in the community who ultimately will be home buyers and will drive up demand for single family homes. Almost everybody started in an apartment. And so that, that's important. And in Wisconsin, the way we fund schools, et cetera, you want to have those young people here with young families. Often they're starting out in apartments, but that helps drive the funding of your schools and you get better schools, and that drives up home prices. So it can work in a couple of different ways. But I think it's the traffic issues for the people that are immediately there in the area, that's one of the driving factors.
And then my last question, Dale, is in your research for this paper, this report, is there any communities in Wisconsin that are making headway or starting to address this problem successfully?
There's two counties in Wisconsin that there's a lot of communities that are trying to figure this out, and they're approaching it different ways. Surprisingly, there's two counties that are already doing something, putting together programs. Washington County and Sheboygan County are working, putting money towards and trying to figure out how to ensure that there's affordable housing in their communities. And normally the counties don't get involved with this, but they're doing some innovative things, and started by looking at what's driving the affordability problem, and they're at the beginning of that process, but they're I think moving in the right direction. I think we'll see more counties sort of get involved in that.
All right. Well, Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association, thank you so much for joining us today. We will link the report, A Housing Hurdle, Demographics Drive, Need for More Homes, on today's episode blog. But thank you so much for spending time with us and trying to demystify this issue.
It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. All right. Well, we're going to take another break. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
Welcome to the Devil's Advocates.
The Republican Party on a national level, how many years did they investigate Hillary and Bill? They're still going to that.
They're still looking for her emails, right? But they don't look in the Trump septic tank for half the top secret classified documents that he was flushing during his term. When one party doesn't care about governing, just don't allow anything to happen when the Democrats are in charge. And then they think the American people are going to get boonswoggled into voting Republican again.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It is the Monday after the first Packers game, and I think everyone right now is licking their wounds.
But I do love that you're leading with The Bears Still Suck as the intro song. I mean, we're already on to week two.
Why are we not good at the season opener.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
I love this song.
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Lows dip down to about 31 overnight under cloudy skies. West winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected again tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 36. A mixture of precipitation likely tomorrow night. Lows level off around 32. Overcast skies. 1 to 2 inches of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 34 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Wisconsin on the Civic Media Network. A reminder that we love hearing from you. If you have a topic that we should cover or a guest that we should have on, let us know. We likely will follow through on that. And also, if you missed this announcement earlier, we are giving away free ad space. Yes. No catch. Don't tell me that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Because the Civic Media Network in our growing stations across Wisconsin means that we have ad space that we want to use to bolster and lift up small businesses across Wisconsin. And so how does this work? What does this actually mean? So on January 26th.
It's a Thursday.
Thursday at 9 a.m., civicmedia.us applications will be open. You have to fill out a couple questions, and then you will work with the Civic Media sales team to develop your radio promo and what that would sound like on air. And literally, it's free ad space. So you get to promote your business for free. And so there's no reason you should not do this.
There's an important caveat, though.
There is an important caveat. So if you're going to do it, I need you to do one important thing. It's maybe the most important thing when you're doing the application. Which is to say that Jane and Kristen on As Goes Wisconsin sent you. That's very, very important because it's not really a competition. Like, I don't think we're going to win anything beyond bragging rights.
It's about bragging
but
rights.
But it really is about bragging rights. And we've already discussed that I come from a very competitive family. I'm a very competitive person. And so when you go on Thursday, January 26th to civicmedia.us on the $1 million ad giveaway, fill out all your information. But make sure you tell them As Goes Wisconsin sent you.
We were the ones.
We were the ones.
Yes.
So just to wrap up our conversation around housing, was that a lot? Was that too much housing for one show?
It was so informative. It really was.
It really, I mean, it's so interesting because it's something that we all need. And, you know, there's a conversation around housing being a human right. And especially affordable housing and the different markets and how market forces are changing and everything. But it's also complicated. And so trying to understand the moving habits and the working habits and the transit habits and how all of this is connected. And so having people who are, you know, obviously looking backwards at certain ways of how we got here and then looking forwards towards the next decade of how we're going to manage all of this. And so I think having these conversations. And also, I think when we talk about the residents, constituents, homeowners who have, you know, trepidation towards new developments, considering, like, it kind of just comes back to, I don't know, it comes back to being, I think, a collectivist and thinking, like, what is best for the community? Because if you're not going to embrace more affordable housing, don't turn around and complain about homeless population increasing, you know, and some of the negative externalities when there's not places for people to live
what that leads to.
Well, and what Dale shared with us, I think the most hopeful thing was that we have some counties now that are getting involved and trying to come up with some plans, because I can see it in my own little neighborhood.
Really?
Well, there's one little house, and it's little. I mean, teeny little. Like, the kitchen is so small, you can't put a kitchen table in it.
Oh, you've seen this house?
I've seen
the
house.
Inside. Okay.
Yep. And it sold last year for $265,000.
Oh, wow.
And
probably not that long ago, it was under $100,000.
Or at least $150,000.
Yeah.
And how is that going to be sustainable?
Yeah.
If the current owner can't sell it for $280,000 or $290,000 or $300,000, I just don't see, again, how this is sustainable unless we're all going to become programmers.
Making that $900,000.
Making $900,000. Yeah, well, or the head of We Energies and make $12 million a year.
That's how much the We Energies CEO makes?
There was, I don't know about the current one, but I'm fairly certain that for previous CEOs, yes. Oh, yeah, pretty good job.
Good work if you can get it.
Exactly. Even if you only do it for a year.
Yeah, seriously. Well, one thing we could all do is just, even if you're not in a, you know, marriage or in a relationship, maybe you could buy a house with some friends or a sibling, because that is a growing, not phenomenon, a growing trend. A recent Zillow survey shows that co-buying or purchasing a home with someone you're not in a romantic relationship with is incredibly common. 18% of recent home buyers purchased with a relative or friend. About 1 in 5 up-and-coming buyers said they intend to.
Wow.
And this is according to the Housing Innovation Collaborative. And so would you, I feel like I see jokes and memes every once in a while, especially for women, of like running off and starting your own commune with all your friends and like owning property, and we can all raise each other's kids and kind of this idealist fantasy of what that could look like. But like, would you actually, is there a friend that you feel like you're like, I would buy a home with them? Because it's one thing, because a roommate situation, you can always, there's less skin in the game.
Right. I love my girlfriends so much, and they save my life every day. And no, I couldn't live with any of them. I could probably do that with one of my sisters.
Why your sister? Is it just because you can fight differently with your sisters because they're family than
I think
your
we
friends?
Can, because you can be a little blunter, maybe. And we're family. I don't know. Not all of my siblings. Trust me, I couldn't live with all of my siblings. And they would say the same thing about
me. Not even
me.
Live with. Co-own something.
Oh, no. No. And you have to be so careful if you do that. Money does twitchy things to people.
Well, and that's why it's interesting. I mean, money does twitchy things in marriages, right?
Yes.
Like the number one reason like listed for divorce is usually money issues and talking about money and different relationships with money. And it's almost the same thing as when you, the advice of don't go into business with family or friends.
Right.
Because if you approach the business differently and you have different ideas and there's butting of heads, that what seemed like a good idea in the beginning and only looking at the upside can end relationships.
Absolutely.
Because what do you do in a situation of, like, what is legally do you get to? Because in a divorce, obviously, there's an end of that relationship. And so, like, the courts get involved as far as breaking up the house.
You got to have some kind of contract.
Yeah. So,
And the other thing to live by, don't loan anyone money if you can't afford not to get it back.
Advice from Jane Matinair. All right. Well, we're going to take another break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, moving on from the housing conversation, let's talk about some Packers. Mr. Aaron Nagler from Cheesehead TV. We started the season with him. We're going to end the season with him. He's going to be here to tell us what he would do if he were the GM of the Packers. And then it's National Bootlegger Day. So I thought we'd revisit the conversation around how Prohibition really bolstered the Packers 100 years ago. All right. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues. From the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Thursdays at 11:30, we are joined by Dr. Michael McCutcheon, who is a psychologist, a lecturer, and additionally, he's won 10,000 fantasy football leagues and loves to help people make easy, free money. Dr. Mike fixes your life and your lineup.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.